Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Saddam Hussein knows UN Security Council resolutions. In the past decade plus, he has flouted 16 of them. Resolution 1441 passed unanimously last Friday and calling for full disclosure of the Iraqi dictator's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction could be the latest if Hussein has his way, or the last if President Bush has his. So far, the Iraqi parliament has dismissed the resolution. The Bush administration, in turn, has dismissed the dismissal. In the meantime, the compliance clock ticks. But is compliance, is peace, a real option? Or will Washington only be satisfied with the kind of house cleaning that comes with war? In this hour, is war with Iraq inevitable? Saddam Hussein is no stranger to rock into hard place scenarios, but he's ruled Iraq for 23 years and counting. I spoke earlier today with Rula Khalaf, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times newspaper. I asked her how Saddam Hussein is likely to play the tough hand he's been dealt this time around.
Well, I think that this situation is different from any other crisis that he's faced in the past, because this is about his own survival. Even during the Gulf War, the objective of the international community was not regime change. It was that he should withdraw from Kuwait. So this is a much more difficult situation for him. It's a situation which does not give him that many options. I think the best that he is looking at is to try to make this last as long as possible, essentially let the inspectors back in and try to drag this crisis out. His hope, I would think, is that this can go on past February, because what a lot of analysts say is that the U.S. would be reluctant to wage a war in the spring and the summer because of peace, and that once you get into the autumn and you start going into a presidential election year, then the calculation of the U.S. administration could be completely different.
Rula Khalaf, can Saddam Hussein, in his security and political circumstances, afford to actually disarm? Can he offer up what the U.N. has demanded?
Well, that's a very good question, because if he thinks that the only way he might be able to fight back or at least complicate the war is by using weapons of mass destruction, then he's going to be very reluctant to give them up. But the problem that he faces, the dilemma, is that at the same time, if he wants to comply and keep some of his weapons, he's probably going to be caught this time by the inspectors.
And the United States is likely to say, here it is, the material breach, let's go.
Yes, I mean, they'd want it to be more than, you know, they created a traffic jam in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is a serious omission in the declaration, for instance, that he will have to make, if he declares that he has no chemical weapons, let's say, and then they discover that he does, then, of course, the Americans will declare a material breach.
Is Saddam Hussein likely to be panicking when he looks out at the situation that he's facing then?
Well, when you talk to people who've met him, who know him, who've spent time with him, they say that he does not panic. Typically, he has nerves of steel and he just holds out. He lives in a world where he always believes that there is some card that he'll be able to play.
And when we see the Iraqi parliament's vote, unanimous vote against compliance with the UN sanctions, then is that interpreted as just part of Saddam's theater of dragging things out, of complicating the situation?
Yes, I think this is exactly what this is. Of course, one can never say for sure that we're going to get an acceptance on Friday, but that is what most people are looking at. The point of the parliament is to sort of show that or pretend that there's some form of debate in Iraq, and also to perhaps step in later on and be able to say, well, despite the fact that everyone in my country says that this is a bad resolution. So much is at stake here that I will save the country and I'll accept it.
Does it appear that Saddam Hussein understands the stakes this time, understands that he does not have a lot of support outside of his own inner circle?
That is difficult to say. On the one hand, yes, because the message from the UN could not have been clearer. You even had Syria voting for this resolution. And in the Arab world, although Syria has had very bad relations with Iraq in the past, today Syria is closer to Iraq than other Arab countries. So I think everyone has tried to make the message clear. But I think what he focuses on is more Arab public opinion. And what he sees is that Arab public opinion, as opposed to war, he sees that even in Britain, there's a lot of opposition to war. Mm-hmm. He gave, in fact, an interview last week to an Egyptian newspaper in which he talked at length about the popular opposition to war.
You discussed his unwillingness to disarm because if it comes to war, Saddam Hussein might want to have those chemical or biological weapons on hand. What about the political ramifications of disarmament for this leader? Can he maintain power in Iraq if he's no longer the boss who sits on top of big weapons?
Well, I think that the U.S. demands do go beyond disarmament. And I think that he has realized that he cannot make a wrong move, not even when it comes to other political issues. And the pattern that we've seen in the past few months is that he has offered appeasement measures. And if one talks to the Kurds or other opposition, what they're expecting is that there'll be a lot more of that.
But if he offers enough appeasement measures within Iraq, he is effectively changing the political system that he's used to dominate the country, is he not?
Little by little, he may have to. And I think that is the other problem that he's facing, is that at some level, there's going to have to be a very serious change.
Ruhollah Khalaf, can you imagine a situation, let's say 6 months from now, where Saddam Hussein has obliged the United Nations, has cooperated with inspections and the demands of the UN Security Council, the UN signs off and says he's got a clean bill of health, and still he sits there in Baghdad in power?
I think it's very unlikely, because I think this resolution has so many onerous requirements that I think somewhere along the way Saddam will make a bad move.
Can you imagine him then surrendering power, leaving Baghdad, going into exile of some kind?
This one can only start to think about when a war is launched, because a lot of it will depend on the nature of the war and whether he's given a chance. It's not clear that anyone's going to allow him to even go into exile.
The options do not look great. Ruhollah Khalaf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ruhollah Khalaf is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. I spoke with her earlier today from London. So Saddam is scrappy. Bush isn't kidding. And somewhere between Washington's tough talk about zero tolerance and UN Resolution 1441's expiration date is the very simple, very important question. Is war with Iraq inevitable? Is the latest Security Council resolution just part and parcel of a build-up to war? Or could it offer a real chance, the best chance, for avoiding conflict? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from New Jersey is Lawrence Korb, Senior Fellow and Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Good evening and welcome, Lawrence Korb. Lawrence Korb, are you there?
I sure am.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear your voice.
Okay.
Lawrence Korb, we're trying to peer through the fog of peace, I guess, so far tonight, and to ask whether, on the other side of all the diplomatic minuet and all the demands and counter-demands and evasion that we may see in the weeks and months ahead, whether war is in fact inevitable within, at the heart of all this, at the heart of the whole matrix of political and strategic interests now up on the board, what's your view? Can war be avoided?
I think it's less inevitable than it was, say, a couple of months ago before President Bush went to the United Nations, because having gone to the United Nations, the president has committed himself to allow inspectors back in and to allow the inspectors to make a judgment about whether Saddam is cooperating in disarmament. And the goal, even the president has said, is not regime change anymore if he disarms. In fact, he said if he disarms, that will in fact be a regime change. So it's less inevitable, or not as inevitable as it was, say, in late August in this country, where we were, you know, practically at a war fever pitch, and people thought we would probably go sometime this fall, certainly so we could have it over with before the hot weather came in.
But Lawrence Korb, help us pick this apart for a moment, because the rhetoric from the Bush administration was so strong earlier this year, even right up to the end of the summer, that somehow President Bush's change of tone and of message, that regime change doesn't have to mean Saddam going, it can ring a little hollow, given how hard and how harsh the condemnations of Saddam were earlier. Do you really believe, in your realpolitik heart of hearts, that the Bush administration could stomach seeing Saddam stay in power 6 months from now, 9 months from now, after everything that's been said and done, if he complies fully?
Well, there are certain elements there that would not like that to happen. I mean, Vice President Cheney has said, you know, inspections won't work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what happened really surprised the president was, over the summer, the uniformed military rose up against the plans, said essentially that containment was working. They had other priorities, and we've been reminded today with the bin Laden tape that he may still be alive and causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Republican establishment rose up, the old, if you will, Eisenhower Republicans, or the Bush 41 Republicans, people like Brent Scowcroft, Senator Hagel from Nebraska, Senator Lugar, who will be the new chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. And I think that gave him pause, and then he began to listen to people like Colin Powell and went to the United Nations. Having gone to the United Nations, he makes it more difficult for him to act at the slightest provocation or to go ahead with regime change if, in fact, Saddam is deemed by the inspectors to have cooperated.
So if that peaceful path is in fact possible, and you say it may be, paint a picture for us, Lawrence Korb, with a little bit of detail here of what that might look like. Saddam Hussein gives the complete inventory of his weapons. The inspectors come in and it looks credible. They question and poke and prod. Nothing shows up. And then what? The UN says, okay, it's done. And Saddam says, I'm still large and in charge. I've given up a couple weapons, but here I still am in Baghdad. Can you imagine that actually happening?
Well, I can, because I think that's what most of the world wants to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the United States, or a certain segment of the Bush administration, that wants to get rid of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we would all like to, and we would like to have gotten rid of Joe Stalin, you know, after World War II, rather than, you know, having to last for 50 years of communist oppression, both in Russia and in Eastern Europe. But Saddam, without weapons of mass destruction, is horrible for his own people. He's like a lot of other dictators around the world, but he's not a threat to regional or international peace.
So your assessment is that the change of perspective within the Bush administration has been so significant that they honestly could tolerate Saddam staying in power without those weapons. They'd be prepared to believe, over a kind of dogmatic opposition, that the weapons are gone and that the U.S. would stand down.
Well, there would be certain elements in the Bush administration, certain elements in the United States that would not be happy with it. But the president would not suffer any problems politically here at home or around the world, because nobody is demanding. He's the one that really started the drum beating with his State of the Union address. I mean, Saddam has been a horrible person. He's been a threat for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We know he has a chemical and probably biological weapons, but he hasn't used them for over a decade now. And so I think the president could. You know, when our plane was forced down in China, you may remember that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said, you know, that plane's going to fly out or else.
This is right after the Bush administration took office and the plane.
And it came out in boxes.
Yes, it did.
And so I think one has to look at that. The president, I think, as he's shown in the last election, is a very astute politician and understands when it's time to change course, if you will. And he pays no price at home or around the world for doing that. He may pay a price with part of his own party's base, but I don't know where they're going to go on this issue.
So you don't think it's lip service when George Bush says war is not inevitable? You think it's the honest truth?
Yeah, I do think so. I think when he says, I haven't made up my mind about going to war, he really means it. Now, there, you know, Don Rumsfeld was going to have an op-ed in the Washington Post here in the latter part of September. They made him pull it. Because it would have given the position that, you know, we've got
tough
to go to war. And they also argue that Vice President Cheney's speech where he said, you know...
Lawrence Cooper, we've got to take a short break. We'll come back and get it. We're asking tonight, is war with Iraq inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight whether war with Iraq is now inevitable. The United Nations resolution would suggest it is not inevitable if Iraq should comply. President Bush has said it is not inevitable. But what do you think? Do you see a real solution shy of war to the standoff with Iraq, a solution that the Bush White House would accept? Is a clean bill of health from UN inspectors enough to end the push for war for you, for President Bush? And do you believe the Bush administration is prepared to accept anything short of regime change? Should it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest at this hour is Lawrence Korb. He's joining us from New Jersey tonight. He's Senior Fellow and Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Lawrence Korb, I'm sorry I had to jump in there at the break.
That's okay.
I guess the question is, we've talked about it from the Bush side. You've said that you believe that the Bush administration, if everything lined up just perfectly in Iraq, that the Bush administration would be willing to accept something short of regime change, something shy of war. What about on the Saddam side? Can Saddam Hussein comply? Will he comply? And can he comply politically within his own environment without being toppled, without being killed, without being made history?
Well, I think he can, because if he gives up his weapons of mass destruction, he's still going to have an awful lot of things that he can do to keep his population under control. We're not going to go in and take away, you know, the guns from the Republican Guard or the conventional, you know, weapons that he possesses.
So we'll still have a military.
That's correct. So, I mean, he still has about 400,000 pretty loyal soldiers that he can use. So I don't think that that's a problem. And he instills such fear into the heart of his citizens that it'd be hard for them to rise up. And remember a couple of times when they tried to right after the Gulf War, and then in 96 he crushed them. And again, these were with conventional, conventional weapons. The real question is, will he be willing to get rid of these weapons? Because without that, then he is not the second coming of Saladin, for example, as he sees himself, or will he be in a position to dominate that region? I think that's
Saladin, great Muslim hero of the Crusades.
That's right. And that's basically going to be, you know, whether he's willing to cooperate. I think that's the real question.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Korb, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Dennis Ross. He's counselor for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was formerly director for policy planning in the State Department under President George H.W. Bush and was special Middle East coordinator under President Clinton. Good evening and welcome, Ambassador Dennis Ross.
Good evening.
Dennis Ross, we're asking tonight whether or not, beyond all the rhetoric and the smoke here, war may, in fact, be inevitable. Lawrence Korb, you've heard just a little bit, but he says he doesn't think it's inevitable that Saddam could comply and that the Bush administration would be willing to accept a resolution of this standoff short of regime change. What's your view? Is war inevitable?
Well, I don't know that it's inevitable, but I still believe that it's quite likely. I think it's quite likely, ultimately, because, in a sense, this has always been Saddam's choice. Mm-hmm. Saddam, I think, is very unlikely to comply with the resolution, although he's very likely to try to create the appearance of having complied with the resolution. I think he, you know, for 11 years, he could have had sanctions lifted at any point, but he didn't do that because he wants the weapons of mass destruction, and especially he wants the nuclear weapons. In his eyes, the nuclear weapons constitute a kind of shield behind which he can go back to doing business the way he used to do it.
A shield in that he would be untouchable if he had that defense.
He would. It would be very difficult for us to stop him because he would have nuclear weapons that he could threaten, not against our homeland, but against our troops. And whether he's whether that is in fact something that would work with us is beside the point. It's what he believes.
So from the Saddam side, you don't see him willing and ready to put these weapons down. What about from the Bush administration side? Can you imagine the White House being satisfied with something less than regime change?
Well, I think once the administration made the decision to go to the Security Council route, then in fact they did shift. I don't simply think they shifted in terms of a slogan. I think they shifted in terms of a policy. And the policy was, if in fact you could produce what you were asking before, a genuinely clean bill of health from the inspectors, would they then be prepared to forego regime change? I think the answer is yes. The president at one point, even though this was quickly corrected, the president at one point said, if in fact that were to happen, that would constitute the equivalent of a regime change.
So, and this despite everything we heard earlier from Cheney, from Rumsfeld, from Richard Perle, that it is sort of building the picture that this man was simply beyond being trusted. He was a fundamentally a menace.
Well, there's no question that many of the people in the administration still believe that, and I suspect, frankly, the President of the United States believes that. But I think the measure of what makes him a menace to the outside world is his acquiring nuclear weapons in particular. And obviously, we know he's still trying to acquire more sophisticated means of dispensing biological weapons as well. So my feeling is that what you have here is a structure that's set up with a resolution. In my mind, it creates a very early test of Saddam, not whether he will agree or accept the resolution this Friday, but whether, in fact, he will provide full disclosure, something that he was required to provide from the beginning.
And this is by December 8th, I believe, he's required
that's
to
correct.
Provide that. So
how
do you see that? You mean that's even before the inspectors are really in and underway.
That's true. But in a sense, what's been understood all along is that inspectors are most able to find things when, in fact, the regime there is actually cooperating with them. The whole ground rule of the inspection regime, going back to the original resolution, was based upon cooperation and disclosure. It wasn't based on the idea that he will hide it and we will try to find what he's hiding.
But is there any way the Bush administration could go to war before the inspectors have even gone in to confirm or cast doubt on that inventory of weapons?
The only way I think they could do it would be if, in fact, what he comes forth with on December 8th, and you know the inspectors will have to study the materials they're handed over. It won't be immediate, but after a week or two, if the gap between what it is we believe we know that he has, and obviously would have to be more than just a supposition, we'd have to have some evidence that we could point to. If the gap between what he is revealing and what it is we know that he has is sufficiently pronounced, then the administration, I think, is in a very difficult position not to demonstrate there's a consequence, because here's the test. Is he prepared for full disclosure or not? If he's not, then it means it's business as usual from his standpoint, which is he will continue to reveal what he feels like revealing. He will hide the rest. And the same will apply to the inspectors.
Just as he's done for a long time. Lawrence Korb, come in here. You hear Dennis Ross saying, no, war's not inevitable, but it sounds like threading the needle of peace is such a monumental challenge. He doesn't see how it's going to happen.
Well, that's the point I was making toward the end, that the real question is, will Saddam be content, you know, to do this? And I think I read Dennis had a terrific piece in today's Washington Post, and I think that's right on whether he will, you know, be willing to do this. I suspect what will happen on December 8th, he'll give a pretty full disclosure and not everything. And then the inspectors will go and find something, and he will claim, you know, that was a rogue element or something that, you know, did that without his knowledge and, you know, execute the people or something like that. I think those are the type of things that are going to happen. They're going to be very ambiguous situations that are going to make it very hard for the United States to say we need to act and act immediately. So I suspect he's not going to make it that obvious when he presents that disclosure on December 8th, and the inspectors are going to have to try and find these things. And if, in fact, they catch him red-handed, he's liable to claim something like that.
But the United States is certainly trying to keep that box very tight around him, even rhetorically now, sort of dismissing any room for wiggle on Saddam Hussein's part. Lawrence Korb.
Could I add a point to that? I think, in fact, if one truly wants to avoid war and produce disarmament at the same time, the only possibility of that happening is if Saddam understands prior to December 8th that he really does have to come clean. and that the consequence of not doing so is that, in fact, there will be a war. If he thinks he's able to play the game the way he has before, then you can count on the fact that he will play the game the way he has before. And I think what Lawrence said is absolutely right, that he's going to, in my mind, he will try to create the illusion of compliance without doing it, but create a degree of ambiguity that others will seize upon to say, look, we see things moving in the right direction. Let's just keep it going this way.
Mm. Well, the message could hardly be up in bigger, bolder lights that there'll be no tolerance of shenanigans this time. And yet we wonder if Saddam can read that. And I guess, for my part, I still wonder a bit if Washington has really turned that corner and would really be prepared to accept something shy of regime change. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Dennis Ross, Lawrence Crowe, please stand by. I want to invite them in. Victor's on the line. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. There's a couple of things I'd like to say. One is I happen not to believe that we're going to Iraq because of those weapons we're talking about.
They're pretty frightening weapons, Victor.
If they are true. And moreover, we gave Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and Rumsfeld himself was there in the 80s, gave him gas, anthrax, and some of that stuff was using Iranians, which at the time was the problem we had, was the Iranian Revolution.
So you think we're on the way to war, it doesn't matter about the weapons?
Excuse me?
You think we're on the way to war and the weapons are just a cover story?
I think the reason we're going there, to be honest with you, is I read that in 98 Clinton said we need a regime change. And it probably has a lot to do with the fact that in 95 and 96, Saddam gave the Russians and the Chinese vast rights to explore oil fields on their own. Mm-hmm. And that whole area has been forever our oil. And we have had a policy forever that was, nobody can come in here and control us. It's ours. It's going to be ours.
And now we see other hands on it. Victor, thank you for your call. Dennis Ross, how about the other issues, apart from weapons of mass destruction, any of them singly or all of them together, is it your view that they are not sufficient to go to war over?
I don't believe that they're sufficient to go to war over. And in fact, I think the point at which the Bush administration changed was September 11th. Look at what their policy was prior to that time. Prior to that time, they weren't focused on regime change. They were focused on having smart sanctions, which was a way to maintain the capability to prevent Saddam from getting weapons of mass destruction, but try to improve what could be happening for his public in terms of their welfare and in terms of humanitarian and non-lethal kinds of forms of not so much assistance, but normal commercial relations being established. So, if oil was the issue, it would have been the issue before September 11th. I think the issue is that the administration became convinced that they could not put themselves in a position, or any of us in a position, where someone like Saddam Hussein could get a nuclear weapon and we could have something like September 11th happen, but with weapons of mass destruction.
And we've heard Richard Perl on this show connect those dots, and he said, look, Saddam must go because he has the intent to build these weapons. He's shown that he's willing and prepared to act on that in the past. And no matter what you do, as long as he sits there with the resources of Iraq at his fingertips, he's going to try and come back and do it. Lawrence Korb, if he got a clean bill of health this time, what's to prevent him from coming back through subterfuge and trying it again? Would the White House live with that?
Well, I think they'd have to, given, you know, the fact that they've gone to the United Nations and the fact that they've never been able to make the connection between the September 11th attacks and al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. In fact, you know, Richard was trying to make that connection through this meeting that may or may not have happened in Prague. Mm-hmm. So that was the connection. And I agree with Dennis. They do believe that he might be able to give those weapons to a terrorist, and there would be a cutout. And they also feel that after September 11th, they have the support of the American people for this, which they didn't have before September 11th.
Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
My question is, I'm kind of curious about whether or not, kind of skeptical whether or not we're going to war, based on whether or not the Bush administration might have more to gain from maintaining with the current sort of level of fear of terrorism, fear of Iraq that we have, similar to what we had in the Cold War. We sort of developed a new enemy. And maintaining this, you know, gradual military buildup, the creation of a new governmental department to encourage the communication between the CIA and the FBI.
But Bill, the only way we wouldn't go to war is if Iraq is certified to be not the threat that it's been presented as being today.
Well, I mean, I see that. However, I kind of see that. But my question is whether or not that the United States and the Bush administration might be looking for more of maintaining sort of a Cold War mentality as opposed to spending the billions of dollars that it would cost to actually go to war.
Let's pick that up, Bill. Thanks for your call. Dennis Ross, you hear the question. On the other hand, yeah, war costs a lot. Is it somehow better to keep it sitting out there as a possibility to keep a war fever going? Do you see the Bush administration really wanting that?
I think, again, you got to look at this president. I think Lawrence was saying this before, and I agree with it completely. Mm-hmm. This president is quite an astute politician.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact is, your rhetoric, what you say, creates standards by which to judge you. One of the things that has made this president, I think, very appealing to the broad American public is that he speaks simply, says what he's going to do, and then he does it. Now, from a domestic standpoint, if after all of this kind of rhetoric and establishing these kinds of standards that the sole purpose was simply to sort of put us in a position where we could maintain a posture out there,
mm-hmm.
I think that would be pretty hard to explain or sell here. I don't think that's what's motivating the administration. I think very much the administration was affected by September 11th, saw a new political reality, saw the possibility to try to deal with this threat, and somehow felt, if you listen carefully to the president and the vice president, that it would have been unconscionable not to take the steps, in effect, that they're taking. What is interesting is, notwithstanding all of that backdrop, the administration made the decision to go to the Security Council route, and it has a set of implications, and I think that's what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Karl Rove is whispering in President Bush's ear now that if, by some miracle, Saddam should comply with the UN resolution, President Bush can declare victory and get a political boost from having stood tall in the saddle, threatened war, won the concessions he wanted without it, shown that talking tough works?
It's a very interesting question, because I think some of the president's constituency will not be satisfied and will feel that there is a gap between the rhetoric and the behavior, and it will look like you're trying to take this and turn it into a victory. I think many others will feel that, you know, not going to war is always a good thing. Mm-hmm. And if, in fact, we succeeded in disarming Saddam, so much the better. This was the proof that, in fact, coercive diplomacy works, and the threat of force is a whole lot better than actually having to use it.
And Lawrence Korb, what about the United States' position in the Middle East? If, in fact, the UN regime, the UN demands should work, they're followed, where does that leave Washington in regard to the rest of the region?
Well, I think it leaves us in a very good position, because this is what they wanted. They did not want us to act unilaterally. When Vice President Cheney traveled to the region last March, they said, you know, you've got other problems out here, the situation between Israel and Palestine,
mm-hmm.
and we want you to take care of that that first. And they would feel that this was the United States, in a sense, going along with the rest of the world rather than, you know, following their own instincts. So I think it would enhance our standing in that part of the world if it would be shown that you could achieve the objective without war, because once war starts, a lot of those countries don't know what's going to happen internally, nor do they know what will happen after the war. And in fact, sometimes I wonder if we know exactly what will happen in terms of, you know, how we will rebuild Iraq, who will rebuild it, how long American troops will have to stay there. So I think the president gains around the world and at home if he achieves his objective without war. And he can claim, as I think Dennis just said, that that's the way it happened, because up until he started talking about regime change, nothing was happening through the United Nations. He was still ignoring all those resolutions.
And we all saw it. We're talking tonight about war with Iraq, asking whether or not it is now inevitable. Was last week's UN Security Council resolution for real? Is the inspection push real, or is it just all eyewash on the way to war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight whether we are now on a path to war with Iraq, an inevitable path to war. My guests tonight are Dennis Ross, former U.S. ambassador, counselor now for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Lawrence Korb. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration, now a senior fellow and director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. Is a clean bill of health from United Nations inspectors enough to end the push to war? Is it enough for you? Would it be enough for the Bush administration? Do you believe the Bush administration is prepared to accept anything short of regime change? Should it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Lewis is on the line. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I wish I could be as confident as your two guests that that war is not inevitable, but I believe it is. And I'm afraid that all the talk from President Bush about regime change not being necessary and going to the UN, all of this to me feels like a little bit like the wolf putting on parts of sheep's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really it seems like even if Saddam Hussein were to comply fully with all of the inspectors and everything that is required, that the Bush administration would not be pleased with that, and that with all of the gearing up and all of the hype that they really need to for their own sort of political credibility, I hate to say it, follow through and go to war.
Lewis, thanks for your call and your observation. Dennis Ross, I guess we've talked about it, but all the buildup over last year and the summer certainly gives weight to this kind of view. You've described the corner that you see the Bush administration having turned, but still one wonders if the administration won't be sitting around the map of Iraq and the reports coming in from Baghdad and from the inspectors with a fine-tooth comb looking for the smallest possible reason to go to war. And maybe that's the right thing, maybe it's not, but can you imagine them being unable to find any reason to take this to war?
No, I can't. I mean, I do feel that there is a paradox here.
Mm-hmm.
The paradox is between the need to maintain, to quote the president of today, zero tolerance on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, and that zero tolerance producing a Saddam's responsiveness when he's never responded before,
mm-hmm.
and yet at the same time, zero tolerance does mean you're kind of on a hair trigger, and it means ambiguity is seen as, in fact, violation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not seen as ambiguity. So on the one hand, you need this capacity to keep the pressure on to ensure that he responds. On the other hand, that itself also creates a certain self-fulfilling prophecy, especially given who we're dealing with. Because mm-hmm. I think, as we were saying before, this mm-hmm. is one of the reasons I think it's still highly likely, if not inevitable. I think Saddam will find it very difficult to respond in a way that the administration would find as being in compliance. And I will say, even for myself, I will be very surprised to see Saddam comply.
What would full compliance look like? How could the United Nations, the United States, know and feel confident that there's no tube of biochemical whatever buried somewhere in a backyard in Iraq?
Well, I think the only thing that you could count on to begin with would be him disclosing things that we had suspicions of or even knew about, but didn't know where they were, and for the first time he reveals. I suspect that he will reveal some new things on December 8th, mostly in the chemical weapons area. I think it's much less likely that he'll reveal new things in the other areas. But if, in fact, he were to reveal across the board everything, mm-hmm. including in the nuclear area, then I think the administration would take it very seriously. I think the key is in part how the inspectors report it, but I do believe that the inspectors are probably very much inclined not to be the ones who assume the responsibility for the decisions of the Security Council. They will report the facts. They won't report more than the facts.
And yet they've got the hot breath of the White House on them very clearly. The White House has been very pointed in saying, we don't want you interpreting, we just want you reporting, as you say. Lawrence Korb, you've expressed a bit more optimism here than Dennis Ross tonight. How do you deal with this hair trigger problem, with the situation where even ambiguity could be seen as a positive trigger to war?
Well, but if it's ambiguous and the United States goes to war, it will pretty much go alone. Maybe it'll have the British, and it will create problems after the war is over in the Middle East and in Europe, because we're going to want help from those countries in rebuilding Iraq. And I think that's the point I've been trying to make. I think Saddam is clever enough to make it so ambiguous that you don't have this hair trigger that the majority of the countries that voted for that resolution are going to say, yeah, this is a clear violation. You know, let's go ahead because he's violated this latest UN resolution. I think he will not do anything that blatant, and that's going to make it more difficult for the administration to make the decision. And if they go where the majority of the people on the Security Council are opposed to them, they're back where they were before they went to the United Nations in the first place.
The supreme test of Saddam Hussein's wiles. Hector's on the line. Hi, Hector. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The Israeli government has called for new elections at the end of January.
Right.
Given the role that Israel will probably have to play somewhere in this whole mix, I wonder from how that might affect the timing of the Bush administration's thinking on a strike against Iraq. I mean, that would seem to be a pretty critical thing to have to consider.
We've got it, Hector. Thanks for your call. Dennis Ross, you know this turf. Do you see the Israeli elections playing any role in the readiness for war?
I do not. I think this is what the administration does in the end is going to be determined by whether or not they feel Saddam has complied or not complied. Look, the president has said last chance. The president has said zero tolerance. The president has said the last 11 years, no compliance, and that's all going to stop now. There's going to be compliance. He's going to be disarmed one way or the other. I mean, the president's established a standard, and the standard he's created is the one that I think will determine, from the administration standpoint, whether they act or they don't act. I agree with what Lawrence said, that what Saddam is going to try to do is create the impression of responsiveness. And I don't believe it'll be complete responsiveness, but he's going to try to create the impression of responsiveness. And I think the inspectors will also adopt a posture that is designed to prove that they will do their job. And maybe, you know, you can't get an answer immediately. I think this is one thing that has really not been completely understood very well is how long it might take the inspectors to be able to give a clean bill of health. You know, the first 60 days which follow the reporting and the disclosure is still basically a preliminary view of the inspectors. And what you're looking at, at the institute that I run, the Washington Institute, we had Rolf Ikeas, who was the first head of UNSCOM, and his judgment is it will probably take 2 years to be able to really determine what he's got and what he doesn't have.
How should we interpret that? We all know that the administration believes it has to go to war by the end of February or March if it wants to have any chance of being effective before the heat comes back in and makes it impracticable. Are we talking about being hanging on this string for another 6, 9 months, a year, more than that, Dennis Ross?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that the administration has to approach this. And the use of military force in the end is going to be governed by, A, whether they think that, in fact, there has been noncompliance, B, the timetable in which they feel that they should act. Now, they may say, we want to see this resolved very quickly, but if the inspectors say, look, we're working, we can't give you the kinds of facts that would be comprehensive yet, it's going to be very hard for us to use military force if inspectors are in Iraq.
It could hang there for a long time. What a prospect. Dennis Ross, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure.
Ambassador Dennis Ross is counselor for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and was with the first Bush administration and under President Clinton as special Middle East coordinator. Let's get one more call. Alan's on the line. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you tonight?
Well, thanks.
I believe that war is inevitable. Unfortunately, I would prefer that we have a peaceful resolution. However, I think Saddam Hussein, the nature of the man, he will want to go out in a blaze of glory. And a likely scenario, well, he'll feign agreeing to inspections. The inspections proceed, and then it'll reach a point where it'll be a standoff. And then he will declare that they are spies or traitors involved with his own government. He'll arrest all the inspectors probably and hold them hostage.
So you see the flavor of the old inspection atmosphere coming back. Our time's running down, but Alan, thank you for your call. Lawrence Korb, this gets to the character of Saddam Hussein and whether or not he's capable as a human being of swallowing the stand down that's now being required of him.
Yeah, and I think that's the key issue. It's really in his hands now. If he is incapable of giving up these weapons that he has or would like to have, then he is going to be put out, and he will be put out with the support of all of the world. And I think the key thing this week was the Arab League voting to support the UN resolution, Syria voting for it. So I think that's really the key. I mean, and he's got to know that if he acts as Alan said, like the old Saddam, he is going to be gone, and with the blessing of a lot of people he thought would support him.
But still, you're optimistic. We just have 20 seconds left, Lawrence Corr, but it's going to take a lot of cool hands around the trigger here to keep from it being squeezed.
Well, it certainly will, and I think, as people pointed out, if we don't go to war and we disarm them, you will have some people in the Bush administration, people like my old colleague Richard Perle, and who will be somewhat unhappy,
and, to say the least.
Yes, but I think it's really in his hands.
Lawrence Corr, thanks so much for joining us this hour. It's been great having you.
Okay, nice to be with you.
Lawrence Corr is Senior Fellow and Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a leading Democrat lashes back at the GOP and his own party. This is On Point. One week after his party, the Democrats, lost majority control of the U.S. Senate and saw the Republican Party increase its majority in the House, 2004 presidential hopeful Senator John Edwards is putting some distance between himself and the Democratic Party leadership. Speaking at a global forum sponsored by Fortune magazine, North Carolina's senior senator took a swipe at the Democrats and Republicans, saying, "Both parties in Washington need to stop spending money we don't have and make a real commitment to fiscal discipline. We cannot meet our challenges unless we get serious about controlling spending. That means spending on pet projects and pet tax cuts." Here are excerpts from Edwards' speech earlier today.
We need a new economic policy in this country that's based on three principles that reflect the lessons of the last 20 years. One, fiscal discipline is the key to establishing an economic climate where business can flourish. Two, the private sector is the engine that drives economic growth, but we all drive faster when there are rules of the road. And three, everyone who works hard in this country deserves the opportunity to share in our prosperity. You know why Americans think that many Democrats want to spend too much money? Because they do. You know why Americans think that many Republicans are too close to corporate interests? Because they are. I believe we should put off the tax cut that President Bush gave to the most fortunate people in America. Whether or not we could afford it when it was originally passed, it is now clear that that tax cut is unsustainable. We've had a recession. We've been attacked on our own soil. We're fighting a war on terrorism. I believe we ought to make the middle class tax cuts permanent. And I believe we ought to offer new tax breaks that will strengthen the economy in the present, because most Americans are hurting now. Addressing President Bush's tax cut is the first step toward fiscal discipline. But we have to also be willing to tackle unnecessary spending. Through smart workplace planning, we can cut the number of government employees and contractors outside the Defense Department, outside Homeland Security, by at least 10% over the next 10 years. Fiscal discipline is a prerequisite to robust economic growth over the long term. But the truth is, we also need a shot in the arm for this economy to promote growth in the short term. I proposed a one-time refundable energy tax credit of $500 per family. This tax cut will put money directly into the pockets of Americans who will spend it, and they will spend it on paying rising heating bills and preventing higher energy costs from them being able to meet other needs for their families. Today, folks are worried from Raleigh to Robbins. They're worried that their mill's going to close in 2 months. They're worried that they're going to be the subject of the next corporate downsizing. At the end of the day, these are the folks that all of us serve, in business and in government. For their sake, we should put politics aside, take responsibility, and get it right.
That was North Carolina Senator and 2004 presidential hopeful Democrat John Edwards speaking earlier today at Fortune Magazine's Global Forum. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.